Eileen, do you remember what you were going to talk about?
Yeah, it was about metaphysics and science. It seemed that they seem to be put at odds with each other. But there is a whole topic in philosophy called the metaphysics of science, where you question what are the ontologies that science deals with. And now there are some philosophers of science who think that that's not the right sort of question to ask. You don't ask if there are laws of nature or if electrons exist or this kind of question. But metaphysics is not simply a system-building activity or a creation of your own personal worldview, necessarily. It's an analytic, it can be an analytic take on the ontological questions connected with each, and well, with all the disciplines that there are. That sounds rather incoherent. You were all arguing very fiercely about the metaphysics of mind just now, before dinner, on the stage. That seemed to me a metaphysical discussion. That's it, really. Sorry if it's rubbish.
Is it rubbish?
Well, I wanted to say that Peter gave a very nice description of speculative metaphysics. Well, I seem to remember when I was studying philosophy hearing about immanent metaphysics or descriptive metaphysics, or some people call it more prosaically, exhibition analysis, where the idea is you contrast exhibition analysis with replacement analysis. So in exhibition analysis or immanent metaphysics, you simply ask the question, what are people talking about? What does a particular person talk about, or group of people? So what are physicists talking about these days? Quarks and strings and psychologists are talking about mental phenomena and mind and so on. And meteorologists are talking about hurricanes. I mean, do hurricanes exist? Or are they completely reducible to atoms in such a way that we should be completely disturbed by the fact that hurricanes will go away one day because they've been completely explained? And this seems to be completely wrong. So I think that in immanent metaphysics, you study the types of things that are referred to by people. And as a creative scientist, and I think it's more the job of the scientist to be speculative. So the speculative metaphysics, to me, is done by physicists and chemists. And the immanent metaphysics is done by the philosophers who are trying to systematise what's going on. And they might criticise the physicists and say, well, perhaps, there's a bit of an inconsistency in the sort of Socratic way. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a real, essentially, a division of labour. And I think metaphysics plays an extraordinarily important role in science. And so, in really modern science, the idea is not so much to reduce one phenomenon to another, but to actually invent new sort of fictional phenomena and theories that you know to be false, but capture the essence of what's going on. So rather than things like mind going away because maybe it gets reduced, what happens is we have a more sophisticated use of the traditional terminology and an introduction of yet new ideas. The new epiphenomena are being discovered all the time, and they don't go away just because they're reduced to something else.
I'd just like to say something quickly to Eileen. Did I hear you say that physicists are not interested in whether electrons exist?
No. I would say that whether electrons exist, rather than sort of shutting up and doing the measuring, whether electrons exist is a metaphysical question.
No, I don't think it necessarily is. Multi-million pounds accelerator devoted to answering that very question.
Okay.
Yes, but the existence of a theoretical particle is a scientific question, not a philosophical question.
It's not a question whether the Higgs boson exists. What that might confirm was that predictions of the nature behaving in such a way as if a Higgs boson existed.
That's the difference. Yes. That Mike put his finger on it.
This one.
Yeah.
electrons, actually, I don't know any physicists who can tell you to define what an electron is. There isn't a definition of an electron. What you can talk about are its, this is quite an interesting ontological sort of consequence of this, because all you can talk about are the properties of this so-called entity, and its comparison with other properties. That's all you can say about it. Although you can say, in fact, I was chided by a philosopher once for saying, you don't even know what an electron is. Well, does it exist? You can't talk about
Hume would be very satisfied with that.
Possibly.
Mm-hmm. No, but this is a model of existence, a model based on concrete things in this world. Yeah. And so we are querying what we mean by existence.
Indeed.
In fact, we're trying to define reality without having the words to describe it.
Yeah.
I mean, what goes for the electron will also be true for a proton,
isn't it?
And in some ways, will be true for tables and chairs.
That's tricky.
Yeah. Actually, I think that's a perfectly reasonable point of view, because if you look at the Bartian, the Bartian theory of physical existence, Berkeley says physical objects exist, but his account of what a physical object is completely different from the account that will be given by Locke or by Descartes. Mm. So a lot of people could agree that something exists without agreeing on what it is.
Mm. You don't know the language.
For example, the electron, actually, because Bohr's account of electron is completely other than the other person.
He knew it at the time as well.
He knew that his account wasn't the right account.
He just knew that it did give some correct predictions.
So the interesting thing is that when whatever had been predicted by Thompson, you can't put it quite like this. Hang on, let me think about it. There was a point at which it was decided by people. Did the electron that Thompson predicted, does it exist, or does the fact that it doesn't have the properties that Thompson predicted of it mean that it's not an electron that exists, but something else? Do we say that electrons exist but they don't have the properties that we said they did? Or do we say that electrons don't exist?
They define
this other thing exists.
This is said over time. Pretty much the first thing you said, but they would put it differently. They wouldn't say it didn't have the properties, that it just didn't behave in the same way, which is a bit of a property, but
the same sort of thing. Yes. So a decision is made about whether, okay, here's this thing, it doesn't behave in the way that we thought it would.
It didn't behave in the way that Thompson said it would. But Bohr came up with another model, which gave correct predictions, but even was more obviously not right.
Mm-hmm.
But he gave correct predictions, whereas Thompson didn't.
Why was it not right?
All to do with the spiral. The electron is supposed to be in orbit around the nucleus, and the theory at that time was that would involve accelerations, which would involve emitting energy, and the whole thing would collapse. They knew that that couldn't happen. They knew that that wasn't right. But the orbits they strive for it, other properties of their orbits, did fit with other predictions. Absorptions and emissions of radiation were at the frequencies that were predicted.
Well, there are lots of hands going on now. We get 1, 2, 3. Put your hands up if you're ready. 4.
So, in my opening remarks, I actually said I thought my number one reason for philosophy being valuable is it enabled you to make a clear distinction between abstractions and what instantiates those abstractions. And I think this is what's going on in this discussion here. So there are different theories of the electron. Well, we were actually talking about atoms rather than electrons for the last few minutes. Each of these theories, the abstraction is very well defined. So the Bohr atom is, you know exactly what's being talked about. And the more complicated ones, the Schrodinger atom, the Dirac atom, and so on. The question is, do any of these atoms actually exist? Is there any real object that instantiates them? That's an empirical question. If you make this distinction, a lot of these discussions become much easier to understand. Mm-hmm.
physicists notoriously don't make that distinction.
Okay, can I just stop you? I've actually lost track of who I said. Tim, will you do the next one? Tim and then I...
Just to respond to exactly that. There's a distinction between believing that something exists like an electron and believing that one's concept of that electron is correct. So the example I would cite is the idea of a force. We still talk about forces today in physics, but the concept of a force is totally different to what the concept was back in Newton's time. So something seems to exist, but it's not the thing. And therefore, when we talk about an electron and the model of the atom, we believe something exists. And there are models using this maths, but that's not the same as saying the model is the same as the thing in itself.
It's still a real answer.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right, I've got you down. What, I'm sorry, I'm going to put this up because I want to write something on the board. And I think actually Bill will put this up for me, and therefore I'm going to just carry on. Patrick, you were going to say something.
Well, I mean, before this discussion of electrons and it seemed towards the end of the last session that the discussions, if you like, came to a point on pinpointed this relationship between philosophy and science. But in fact, the nature of the day was also about what's the point of philosophy, and there's, I think there's areas of philosophy which are not related to science or even the philosophy of science actually, which perhaps I would perhaps like to explore a little bit further. There's the whole areas of philosophy of law and philosophy of the arts and aesthetics. And I think Peter Dishon asked, he thinks that perhaps one activity, what are you doing when you're looking at these things? So we could perhaps like to explore, what are you actually doing then? Are you stepping back as a second order activity in looking at scope, the methods, the nature of the particular activity you're looking at? And but we focus mainly on the philosophy of science and philosophy, but there are other areas. Ethics, for example.
No, I was something that I've offered once before, but it might be helpful. I certainly found it helpful, and it was something that just as summing up all the picture as A.C. Braley saw it, I just offered it to him, and he was here to you as well. He was discussing the stretch and the width and the span from the use of philosophy, and the way he put it was, it's thinking for the sake of thinking, but a natural outcome of that is that there are some questions that get answered in the course of thinking about them. So when you get a question answered, you get a sort of it closes off that area of philosophy and turns it into something he called the daughter of philosophy. So an independent discipline, because philosophy, by the width and the stretch and the multitudinous nature of curiosity, has actually answered that area. So he went through, he listed the independent, some of the independent quarters of philosophy, which he said broke off and went down their route and carried on challenging their area that philosophy had therefore isolated for them. And so his examples were of, let me see, he said in the 17th century we got natural science, which came out of the search of philosophy in general terms, closed off and broke off into an independent daughter of philosophy. In the 18th century you got psychology breaking off into a separate independent daughter of philosophy. In the 19th century, you've got social science breaking off as an independent daughter of philosophy. I'll carry on in spite of my laughing. And in the 20th century, you get the artificial intelligence and brain science, also independent daughters of philosophy. And we still thunder off, carrying on with our speculative thinking. and therefore having created these independent laws, then go on.
And back in answer to Anne's question,
exactly.
What is a philosophical question?
Exactly.
It's the unanswered questions that the other bits can't answer.
That's right.
Just going back briefly, I know we've moved away slightly, but back to the idea of electron. I always like to quote Stephen Weinstein.
Quote yourself, I'm going to write on the board, it's got nothing to do with you.
Absolutely. I always like to quote Stephen Weinberg, who by his own admission is arch-realist. And in his book, The Dreams of Final Theory, he said something like, when I say something that something is real, all I mean is a kind of respect. That all I mean is to say that I cannot find things about this something which exists without making an effort. But really, it matters very much, very little to me, no more than nobility titles meant to Lloyd George by issuing the type of reality. It just shows that they don't really mind whether it is real or not. So, you know, scientists are not realists in the philosophical sense. We should not be confused by the terminology used by science. It is just a term of respect. It does not mean any ontological commitment. And that's from an arch-realist by his own admission.
This is one of the ways in which I would distinguish science and philosophy. An empirical theory, let's say, says that there is something that satisfies three descriptions. I mean, whatever the descriptions are, it doesn't matter, it's irrelevant. This is a theoretical entity, let's give it a name, let's call it a funk. Okay, great. So we've got this hypothesis, which is that funks exist. Funks exist and they have these three properties, or these three ways of behaving, which is, of course, as you said, a property. So empirical studies then say, okay, that's interesting, funks exist. Let's see whether we can show that funks exist by finding what they actually are in their intrinsic self without their just being whatever it is that plays this role in a theory. And so empirical studies show that there is something that has that property and that property, but actually not that property. So it behaves in that way, it behaves in that way, but it doesn't behave in that way. And the interesting question is this a funk or not?
It depends on whether it's an essential property.
Absolutely.
Well, okay, but hang on, now you're getting into philosophy in a big way, because this is, to start off with, a philosophical question, is this a funk or not? It's got some of the properties of funks. It's playing the role almost that we said that funks would play in this theory, but not quite, because it's not doing this, whatever it is.
Poincaré almost predicted the theory of relativity, the special theory, and said if that was to be true, we wouldn't have space and time.
We wouldn't call it a...
We wouldn't call space and time the same thing. It would have to be different from what we mean.
But that's just an instance
of
this problem.
Many instances.
So what you're saying is...
People make a choice.
There was, so can I put what you're saying in this way? Maybe I can't. Let me see. So the theory said there is space and time. There are these things. Let's call them space and time. Empirical studies, I think Poincaré was an empirical scientist.
Yes.
Shows that.
Well, it was Einstein who showed that there was something that happened in the properties, but not all.
Okay, so exactly this. And then the question is, have we shown that space exists, that time exists, or have we shown that they don't exist?
My point is that Poincaré said that we would have a choice of either saying that space and time are as we imagine and therefore don't exist, or something like that. Or we would change our definition of what space and time is.
Yeah.
And he rejected that second choice, which meant he didn't discover relativity.
So there are two possible answers to this question. One is, yes, funks exist, but don't have the properties we thought they did, or the properties that the theory predicted. And the other is, no, because these things that we've established empirically, these things don't have the properties predicted by the theory, they are not funks.
There is a third answer, which is that you've shown, you haven't shown that funks don't exist, you've just shown these other objects are not funks.
Yeah. There may be funks, exactly.
That's
okay.
The conclusion I would draw.
So possibly funks exist, but these are not they.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. They're not approximately funks.
There are only approximate funks. But you see, and actually, I'd just like to say for those of us who are not physicists here, who are not scientists of any kind, that you can do exactly the same thing for justice. So for example, Socrates is saying, you know, there is this thing called justice, what exactly is it? And it might be that we look at the way life works and da da da, and we think actually there's this thing that approximates justice as Socrates defines it, but isn't exactly like Socrates, like justice as Socrates defined it. Therefore, are we going to say that justice exists or that it doesn't? And that is a decision. It's not an empirical, it's not something you'd say, this is how we must answer. Because we're not forced into answering any particular way. We could answer that way, or we could answer that way, and we make a decision based on, well, based on what? Reasons, but the reasons aren't determining us in either direction.
And didn't that really come from Wittgenstein, who showed that was the most uninteresting question?
Sorry, what was the most uninteresting question?
The question, is this a fun or is this not a fun?
Yeah. Oh.
He said it's one of these linguistic puzzles that are considered philosophical problems, but aren't. The sort of example he gave is that of a dog which circles a cow, but the cow all the time turns to face the dog. The question is, has the dog gone round the cow?
Of course it has.
No, of course it hasn't. It's never been behind the cow. So long as we know what happened,
doesn't matter. And it's certainly true that actually there is something that exists, and whether it's a funk or not is actually not very important.
You've described the situation. Yeah. That's all we need to know. Yeah. Ask these silly questions of definition is irrelevant, redundant.
Well, except that we do want to know, don't we, whether funks exist or not, and if they do exist, what their properties are.
Well, the scientists talk about knowing funks. The word funk, you call it funk, or you don't call it funk. I mean,
you know what the physical facts are. That's what matters.
Sorry, the it you're talking about?
The funk.
We don't know that it is a funk. The fact is, if we've got an it, we want a name for it,
sure,
and we want to know what its properties are.
The scientist wants to know, but the philosopher is wasting his time.
Yes.
No.
The it, you want to know, what are these its? Well, we have found out they're not funks. The philosopher is interested in the types of reasoning that the physicist might be using in order to work out what these its are.
Well, this is where I think it starts to be interesting. You've all heard of Libet.
Yeah.
He talks about the whatever it was that comes just before the action potentiality or something, and he calls it an intention. Now, actually, I think it matters enormously whether this thing is an intention or a desire. But he actually uses them interchangeably. And at that point, I start to think, well, actually, if you use intention and desire interchangeably, you're not on the same page as me.
Could you say a bit more about that? Yeah. Could you tease out that distinction that you see?
I can try, but if you remember, his experiment was that there's a point at which a conscious decision is made. That's what he called it, a conscious decision. He called it an intention. And it comes just before. No, hang on, I've got to get this right.
It's after, the other way around.
Comes after.
After.
Yeah.
The
action potential.
The action potential. Exactly. Yes, you're right.
And then what
happens? So this is the action potential which actually leads to the movement. And at this point is where you have the conscious
awareness.
No, you don't.
All you have
At that point, you have registered that you have made a conscious decision. But the fact of registering is not identical to the act of decision.
And but the thing is, okay, let me just report the facts. This is what Libet said. What he said was, first you get the act of potentiality, here you get the physical,
I can't follow this because I'm not sure how this is in any way connected with our talks today. If you tell me how to the rain, then I'll see the point of following it.
Okay, no, that's fair enough. Because the question is whether something's a pump or not important philosophically? And I was offering an argument for thinking that there are times when whether something is an X or not are important. And the thing I chose to illustrate it was Libet's experiment, where the question is whether something is an intention or not, or a desire or not, is, I think, hugely important.
I didn't know that he called it an intention.
He called it an intention.
Is this late Libet or middle Libet?
I honestly don't know which Libet it is.
You also said you can ask the same questions about justice, say justice or love. I don't really think you can ask the same questions about a table and a chair, properties, and properties of justice and love, but you would think you can.
What Libet said was, there is no free will, and we know that because first there's the action potentiality which leads directly to the action, and then there's the conscious decision.
Okay.
And so you haven't got free will because this would be the point at which free will would enter, but as a matter of fact, the action is already determined by this.
By several hundred million seconds.
But it then becomes really very important whether that's what exactly that is, what sort of mental state that is. Because if you just want to raise your hand, you would expect that.
Are we getting bogged down? Yes.
We are. Yeah. We are. Thank you. Yeah.
If this theory were true, how would you explain something like thought tension, where you have to respond very, very quickly to something that you don't know before?
Not quite as quickly as the
answer. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good point, because they've actually done things like tennis playing.
It's not at all clear who is playing
tennis. It's the body of a tennis player. Yeah. Because his mind cannot work that hard.
Which was important, isn't it? Yeah.
Could it be reasonable for us to discuss that the point of philosophy is a very narrow one? It's only to discuss very narrow points of sort of metaphysics and language. And it's not to discuss wider issues of ethics and political philosophy and many other aspects of philosophy which other people may think are part of philosophy. Because what I've heard today seems to concentrate on a very narrow spectrum of what I think of philosophy.
Too narrow, I agree. Yeah. So we ought to move to it.
Can I? Is it my turn? Yeah, because I want to. When I asked you what was that about, and you didn't give me an answer that connected, but further on you mentioned free will, and now that's exactly what I want to talk about as well. And that's how you came by that, but you didn't explain to us why you were right, and you just wrote something, and in your mind it was to do with free will. I didn't know that until you did it. I suppose this is connected with more like ethics or moral philosophy and connected with what and I think a lot of people here are saying they don't believe in free will. But I just wonder if you could answer something that's difficult for me, and I've not been able to come up with this. I mean, who are we? What is a person? Surely we have to decide that before we start to think, well, what is a good life? What is the good life? Is this even a suitable question? And then Anne tells us, and other people who might believe this, we are the sum of our experience.
We are
our experience. And I have to say, well, yes, that makes a lot of sense.
in some ways, in most ways, what else can we be? But I happen to wish, and this is just wishful thinking, that surely there can also be a window, however small, for some kind of individual reflection and decision, i.e. free will. If not, then this is my problem. Is there any place at all for ideas and discussions about what is right and wrong? Moral and immoral behaviour, such as harming people. And Anne used this example. Someone may be much more likely to water the roses than murder their mother, but one possibility could be that suddenly the mother's gone mad and is about to stab her child or grandchild. Is there no room for a decision that in this wholly exceptional situation, murdering the mother is preferable to allowing the death of a son or a daughter? And a decision be made. I find its lack of space for responsibility for behaviour a reason for feeling that I have to reject the this absence of free will, in the same way as I always felt very unhappy with David Deutsch's idea of the multiverse, in which anything that can happen does happen. Because no one can be held responsible for their actions. The murderer sitting here by me in some other part of my universe. This is the end. He didn't do it.
I'd just like to make a very quick comment. I mean, Chris, when we had this meeting, I mean, with four talks in one afternoon, one can't cover the whole of the philosophy. The last member's day focused on ethical questions. So I don't think anybody's suggesting for a moment that ethics, aesthetics, philosophy and politics are irrelevant. It's just that they
point is not to complain there isn't any moral philosophy. It's to ask the people who say no to free will, do you have no basis for morality then? Is there? Can you explain it to me if there still is one? That's all.
I don't see how the fact that, well, sort of your rejection of free will necessarily means that if you don't believe in free will, there is no room for morality. It's still, even if you have some sort of absolutist, there's still room for people to be either right or wrong, even if they chose neither path, and still definite scope for them to hold responsibility for their actions and to be punished for that.
How?
Well, how not? Why?
If determinism is true and there is no free will, then there is still punishment of right and wrong.
Well, still
so
right.
That has to be right.
But not responsibility for action.
So culpability.
Isn't the discussion just at the modern level? You're right, we're supposed to be discussing what's the point of philosophy.
Yeah, it should be
not discussing individual ethics.
It's metaphysical.
We keep getting more.
Well, we did come a lot of
different.
Really?
Well,
we should be talking about, I thought we were talking about the methods and the nature and scope of philosophy.
Yes.
What's the point?
We should be.
Not
this
not.
Is. What is a good life is a fairly.
No, I agree that this is getting behind it. If the whole point of the day is to talk only about the point of philosophy and nothing else, and I think that's perfectly reasonable,
yes.
Then to get into whether free will exists and so on.
How did the methods of philosophy differ, say, from the methods of the arts or the methods of science, for example?
Mm.
I'd like a bit more feedback on that. I mean, you touched on it in the talks. Are there unique methods to philosophy as opposed to the arts or the sciences?
My view is it's just science is obviously rooted in empirical research. The further you get away from empirical research, the closer you're getting to philosophy, the more abstract you get. And as soon as you've blatantly gone thoroughly abstract, and really when it's sort of cross-disciplinary and you're dealing with problems that arise at all sorts of different levels, empirical levels, then we're suddenly into philosophy. I mean, that's what I'm just describing as the upper echelons of science, really, and that's what I think. I mean, my personal view is that Plato's theory of forms is a scientific theory, and it's probably wrong.
When we were talking about what exists a bit earlier, I was thinking of this article by Quine, which I think is a very much discussed one, which I think is called On What There Is. And he begins, for my money, incredibly promisingly, because he says, the ontological question is very, very easily asked. You can do it in three words, and it is, what is there? And then he says, and the epistemological answer to it is even simpler to do it in one word, everything. Mm-hmm. So what is there? The answer is everything. And I when I started to read his paper, I thought, whoopee, you know, this is it. And then he spends the whole rest of the paper backpedaling and saying, well, okay, everything, but not this, not that. And by the end, I was going to get disappointed. But if you start from the view that if you ask the question, what is there, and your answer is everything, and you take it seriously, then of course an electron exists. And so does an idea. And so does an idea, and so does all industrial
things.
They all exist. And so does God, absolutely. And what you have to ask is, exist as what?
Well, no, what you have to ask is, what does everything include?
Yeah, well, if you be as generous as you can be and say, let it all hang out,
everything exists.
Everything.
But then what does everything include?
Well, each time you ask me of a thing, does this exist? My answer is yes.
Unicorn.
What do you mean by
this? Of course unicorns exist, but they exist as statues which human beings have made from a mixture of horses and
gentlemen over there.
Does an electron exist when it's making a quantum jump between one orbit and another?
It exists as an idea. Yes.
It's a
mental
model. On who you speak to. It depends on who you speak to. I haven't. David.
Yeah. Pulling back really to the topic of the day. Some of you will no doubt have seen the film The Life of Brian. And one of the questions in that wonderful play was, what have the Romans done for us? And so, well, they've done sort of roads. Yeah, well, what else have the Romans done for us? Well, irrigation. Yeah, come on, what else? It turns out, of course, that the Romans have done a heck of a lot. My question is, what has philosophy done? In other words, what I'm sort of looking for is a list of things that wouldn't have happened for the good without philosophy.
I thought I said that.
Okay, that's fine.
I thought I started it off in a very thin version of A.C. Graham's list.
Okay.
I gave you one
per
century. He had more.
Okay.
Can I turn the question around a little bit?
Yes.
I've got a question. Who doesn't do philosophy?
You have to ask what philosophy is, obviously, to know whether anyone is doing it. And it seems to me pretty clear that it's different things across time, and it plays different roles socially across time. And what I wanted to raise was, what is the social role of this academic discipline now? Because I thought our question was in the present tense.
Isn't it just an academic discipline?
Sorry?
Is it just an academic discipline?
Well, I think now that's what it is.
But doesn't anybody get involved in philosophy?
Well, anybody can get involved in any academic
discipline. No, but doesn't everybody get involved in philosophy?
I don't think so.
Some philosophers have made a difference. Hobbes made a difference. Mill made a difference. Because their political and ethical philosophical theories actually influenced.
Sorry, people talking across each other, not allowed.
Frank's making a very interesting point.
I would say that some philosophers have actually made a real difference to the way we live. Namely, political and ethical philosophers, I would say, and the examples I gave were Mill and Hobbes. Both of them had to be taken notice of. And then you've got people like Rawls since then, and I'm sure lawmakers, John Locke, probably you could name others. Philosophy has actually made some practical differences to the way we live, because without them, I mean, utilitarianism is built into the way we think. To an enormous extent.
So it's Kantianism.
Well, I was going to say, ontology, that I think is slightly the other way around, insofar as we had values which then Kant said were necessary values, he systematized, where, and of course Mill systematized as well, but I think developed our utilitarian thinking to the extent that it made more difference, I mean, with his famous essays and being a politician himself. So I think there are living and active philosophers, and I expect, well, I mean, Plato, of course, got involved himself in politics, and whether he wasn't very successful. But again, philosophers, through their philosophy, have made a difference. So one of the points of philosophy, presumably, is to alter not only the way we think, but through that, the way we behave nationally.
Peter,
just a couple of points. Just quickly, David, what a philosopher has ever done for us. I offered in my talk an answer that they've mapped arguments. So we have this fantastic map of arguments. You say, where do the arguments lead? You don't have to start from scratch because you go and read these books and they show you where the arguments lead. It's like mapping in the Amazon, though, is the way I see it. You know, they've mapped it out for you. So it's a fantastic achievement. I want to comment on Anne's thing. The Quine article, I cite it, it's in the bibliography of my talk, and it is the classic source of the sort of metaphysics that I was attacking, which is that you just take what the language says and you construct this theory, and basically all it is what your quantifiers refer to, so whatever a variable refers to that exists, you know. Hang on. There's a very nice article by Jonathan Schaffer that's been very influential recently, and it starts off with an attack on Quine. It just says, Quine's question, what is there, is actually a very boring and quick question to answer. You have a bit of divergence over whether people think gods exist or not, but on the whole, that argument takes about half an hour, what exists, and then you're left with the question, which he thinks is the big question, which is what grounds what? What's the relationship between them? If you think this thing exists, you know, if you think unicorns exist, what is the ground for unicorns? You know, are they fictions? Are they brain events? Are they, you know, and the structure of reality is the thing we're after, not just the component bits, you know, but how does it all fit together? That's what metaphysics and ontology is about. I like that.
But you've got to let it all exist in order
to
put it into a structure.
Yes, but I mean, I mean, you and I seem to agree pretty much on what exists.
Mike, I'm sorry, I'm putting you and, I don't know your name?
Andrew,
and then David. Because they haven't spoken before.
Talking about the purpose of philosophy, doesn't it, Western philosophy, it underpin Western civilization? We start off with Socrates, and he's arguing against the sophists and the rhetoricians, who just want the art of argument to win their point. But Socrates is actually searching for something that's higher than self, for a truth. It's a truth based on a coherent argument and logic. But from that moves on to Aristotle.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong. That's the start of the birth kind of Western thought. And Aristotle then brings in the empirical aspect, which is the other stream of philosophy that leads to science. So the whole philosophy is responsible for our whole civilization thing.
Well, there's an answer to what is
wrong.
David.
Yes, there's a lot of talk about does something exist or not, but as if that is a really important question. It seems to me that it can very easily become a very unproductive way to go forward. Now, if people speak things and people hear of those things and know what they're referring to, they usually mean something. And so rather than say, what you're talking about doesn't exist, shouldn't we be asking, what kind of existence does this have in relation to other kinds of existences? So if I say that I did something last night, and you hear me, and then I say, well, actually, it was a dream. And then you change your understanding of it. And then I say, well, actually, I didn't have that dream. I was lying to you. I changed it again. So, but each time, I'm referring to something that you know what it is. That each time, it has a different kind of existence. And to discuss whether any one of them exists or not is not really addressing the important question, it seems to me.
Peter?
Yes.
Yeah.
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 Well, then you've got to ask, why do they exist? Then the next question is, exist as what? So I'm very happy to say God exists. I'm an atheist. So my next question is, God
exists. You're an atheist, and you're very happy to say God exists.
Of course. God exists, but God exists as an idea which human beings have invented. But ideas are real. You know, you can't say ideas don't exist.
But I wouldn't say God exists, but only God is, because to me, exist means time and space.
I think Mike and then Andrew.
I just need to leap to defense of Quine, because Quine quite often is quoted without the relevant bit. Elsewhere in the same essay, or it may have been in a Tudogmas essay, he also says, of course, I'm not suggesting for a moment that that what exists depends on the language one speaks, but what one says exists does.
Yes, I
don't take Quine as meaning that existence he's talking about is the existence in ontological sense. He's only talking about ontological commitments, not about ontology itself.
Mm-hmm. When we quantify over something, in other words, when we say there is.
Exactly.
We are expressing our belief that this thing exists.
We are committed to saying that it exists, but it doesn't mean that it exists.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I can believe that God exists and yet my belief be false.
Exactly.
You said ideas exist. Mm-hmm. And my question is, well, are these ideas materialistic?
Yes.
They are materialistic. Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that what the ideas are about are materialistic.
No. I mean, do they comprise
God
of matter?
God exists in a sense, neurological
thing.
You can have ideas that have a real potential in the real world. When the rebels went into Tripoli, there was a debate going on amongst Libyan people, is Gaddafi still in control? Well, he's only in control if people believe he's in control. But that seems to be the key question. Is he still in control of the city or not? Should we still do what he tells us to do? So the concept of control is something that's purely in people's minds, but it actually has a real potential existence.
But they might also have been thinking, are people giving their commitment to Gaddafi still or not? Mm-hmm. Are people not giving their allegiance, but are they effectively thinking we have to because everyone else needs?
But there's a sense that there is something that exists called control, and does he have it or not? And people all knew what the word meant, and yet they don't stop to necessarily think of those questions. But there's a belief that there is something that exists, and oddly enough, it does exist in a certain way. But of course, not in the way that people first thought.
Other last drop that they think this is a concept, and to my mind, it's extremely unfortunate that in modern philosophy, because I'm even conceptualism, Islam to this nominalism. I have no idea why.
Well, that shut you all up. And actually, it's just as well, because we've run 5 minutes over time. We're supposed to finish at 9, I think.
Bar's open.
And the bar's open. I'm in Chelsea, so good. I get the impression that people would like to talk on, and that's great, but I think maybe we should talk on in the bar. So thank you all for coming. I'm delighted you were able to come, and I think the whole weekend, the whole day has been interesting.